Hello and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil on this Friday, December 18th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Let's take a look at today's front page first story. Man wanted in Bluffs killed in border shootout. Accomplice arrested locally. Reported by Sam Pimper. A man wanted in connection to a Thanksgiving Day Council Bluffs shooting is reportedly dead after exchanging gunfire with U.S. Border Patrol agents in New Mexico. And an alleged accomplice during the November incident is in custody. Megan Bressman, 30, of Omaha, was arrested Wednesday on a warrant for her alleged involvement in the shots fired case in the 1300 block of North 25th Street, according to a news release from the Council Bluffs Police Department. Police said Bressman was located at a home in the west end of Council Bluffs and was taken into custody without incident. She was transported to the Pottawatomie County Jail on a Council Bluffs police warrant for accessory after the fact, as well as other valid warrants coming out of Nebraska, according to the release. Bressman had her first court appearance Thursday morning and is scheduled for a December 23 arraignment, according to Pottawatomie County Jail booking. She's being held on a $2,000 bond for her alleged aggravated misdemeanor offense. The investigation leading to Bressman's arrest was led by the Council Bluffs Police Department Criminal Investigations Division. On November 26, police say a woman went to a convenience store to pick up coffee and while exiting the building, encountered a man walking rapidly toward her who began firing shots. While driving away, her vehicle was struck twice. However, the woman wasn't injured. The motive for the incident wasn't determined by police at the time, they said. The shooter, believed to be Benjamin Manley by Council Bluffs Police and the U.S. Marshals Service, was reportedly killed Wednesday following an incident at a southern New Mexico Border Patrol checkpoint, according to Will Iverson, a deputy U.S. Marshal out of the Omaha field office. Manley reportedly arrived at the checkpoint and proceeded to exchange gunfire. We found out last night that there was a pursuit and shooting in New Mexico, and the person involved was probably Manley, Iverson said. And I see that confirmation came sometime late yesterday, if not early evening. We are working with the marshals down there to confirm identity, confirm people's stories. We did have information that he may have been trying to get to Mexico, so this doesn't surprise us. Court records show Manley was previously sentenced to 15 years imprisonment in 2008 after he was arrested for shooting at a U.S. Marshal near Quick Trip on Saddle Creek Road in Omaha in 2000. A second story on the front page, Candy Canes for James. School rallies around Longfellow student after surgery. This is reported by Tim Johnson. The Longfellow Elementary School family has rallied around a third-grade student who recently underwent heart surgery. The staff raised more than $1,000 selling candy canes and presented gift cards and presents to James Lafferty and his family Wednesday afternoon. His sisters, parents, grandparents, and two cousins were there for the occasion. James is a good kid, his teacher, Maddie Misfelt, confirmed, and so are his sisters, according to Amanda Cool, another teacher. They are super polite and just the kindest people, Cool said. James 8, son of Robert Lafferty and Jasmine Geyer, was diagnosed with a heart valve defect when he was 3 years old. Geyer said, extra tissue at the bottom of his aortic valve was causing the blood to flow faster. She compared it to the way water pressure increases when you partially block water coming out of a garden hose with your thumb. The added pressure was hard on the valve. On December 1st, a surgeon at Hospital and Medical Center in Omaha performed open-heart surgery on James to remove the extra tissue, Geyer said. The open-heart surgery was to prevent more damage to the valve, she said. The four-hour operation went well, and James was released from the hospital Saturday, Geyer said. He's having a good recovery. He is such a strong kid, she said. You wouldn't even know he had surgery. James does have some restrictions, however, including not lifting more than 4 pounds, Geyer said. If he has a dental procedure or anything that breaks the skin, he has to have antibiotics to prevent infection. He can't do anything that's going to risk him falling or hitting his chest, she said. The main problem is getting him to slow down. James' parents learned in early November that he would have to have surgery, Geyer said. November 20th was his last day at school before the operation. When the staff at Longfellow Elementary School found out, they wanted to raise money for his family, Kuhl said. It started out as a GoFundMe campaign, but she wanted to include students in the fundraising. I thought, here's an awesome opportunity for kids to get to know their Christmas spirit, she said, or to show it. The staff started selling candy canes and got an initial donation of 300 candy canes from Hy-Vee, Assistant Principal Chris Douglas said. A couple other stores pitched in, too. We sold out of them so fast we had staff who just went out and bought more, he said. This is something we do every year, but it's usually just a student council fundraiser, said Kuhl, who spearheaded the effort. Many students became repeat customers or big buyers. We had students who would buy for their whole class, said Morgan Thompson, a math instructional coach. Staff members also contributed. Custodian Tim Penn donated a $200 Walmart gift card, Kuhl said. The staff used the gift card and some of the candy proceeds to buy winter gear for James and his three sisters, Chastity, 11, a sixth grader, and Kern Middle School. At Kern Middle School, Kaylee, 9, a fourth grader at Longfellow, and Michelle, 7, a second grader at Longfellow. Then the staff decided to have an angel tree for the family, Kuhl said. They got each child's wish list and size and put them on the tree. People went above and beyond that, she said. When it was all said and done, the team had raised $1,133 from selling 2,266 candy canes at 50 cents each, Kuhl said. We had $315 in quarters, Douglas said. Assorted gift cards and donations pushed the total raised to more than $2,000, he said. It's not just from our school, it's from our staff, it's from our students, it's from our families, Douglas said. There were virtual academy students who had not been on campus all year who called and asked if they could contribute. It turned out to be so much more than we imagined, Kuhl said. It was a nice opportunity for us to just give back. The article is accompanied by a color picture of the Lafferty family standing behind large bags of something, probably candy canes, and maybe there's James holding a large check with the amount on it of $1,333, and the check has the symbol of a lion, a lion's head, to the left top corner. Included in the picture are some staff of the Longfellow Elementary School. All of the ones in the picture are wearing some kind of winter clothing, and all of them are wearing masks. At the bottom of the first page, first babies delivered at Jenny Edmondson's new unit, reported by Tim Johnson. The first baby arrived at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital's new Women and Newborns unit Wednesday after opening Tuesday, and four more followed, according to Dr. Lori Platt. We were busy yesterday, she told the Nonpareil. On Thursday, we delivered 5 babies in 24 hours. Platt delivered a first one, a boy named Riggins, via cesarean section at 8:20 a.m. Wednesday, according to his mother, Lindsay. He was 21 inches long and weighed 8 pounds, 4 ounces. It was so exciting, Platt said. It was such a great morning. Everybody was smiling. Lindsay has been seeing Platt for more than 2 years now, she said. I've been seeing her for all my prenatal care, and she's the one who delivered my daughter, who is now 19 months old, she said. They treated us so well during our first delivery. They're a close-knit group that takes care of their parents. We even had the same nurse we had for our daughter. Lindsay had some complications with that pregnancy, but this one went better. She was anticipating going home today. That would be Friday. We had no complications this time, she said. Dr. Platt has caught every detail that could have caused a turn. It's just kind of neat how on top of things she is. Lindsay chose Jenny because of her relationship with Platt, not the new unit, but she did enjoy the new facility. It's gorgeous, she said. The old unit was nice, but this is definitely top-notch. And even having the first baby here, there were no kinks to smooth out. The fifth floor was completely remodeled to create the new women and newborns unit, which replaced the previous one on second floor. Said Platt, it's just nice for patients to really feel like Methodist Jenny Edmondson is really dedicated to the community. The Jenny Edmondson Foundation gave Lindsay a tote bag with several baby items, Lindsay said. The article is accompanied by a color picture and a group photo, under which the caption says Dr. Lori Platt, obstetrician-gynecologist, Nurse Stephanie Thompson, RN, Ashley Nilsson, Unit Director, and Nurse Amber Williams, RN, gather around Lindsay and her one-day-old son Riggins Thursday. Riggins was the first baby born in the Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital's New Women and Newborns Unit. And we have another story on the front page. Feenstra, flood of mailed ballots, reason for delay in declaring Joe Biden president-elect. This is reported by Aaron Murphy of Lee Des Moines Bureau, and it's from Johnston. An historic number of early and absentee ballots cast in the 2020 presidential election and President Donald Trump's failed legal challenges are why Congressman Randy Feenstra said he is not yet ready to call Joe Biden the U.S. president-elect. Feenstra, a Republican from Hull, is the newly elected representative for Western Iowa's 4th Congressional District, which includes Harrison County, far and away the most conservative-leaning of the state's four districts. During recording for this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS, Feenstra on Thursday said he looks forward to January 6, when Congress will receive the Electoral College results. Democrat Joe Biden defeated Trump, the Republican incumbent, in the presidential election in November. Ever since the race was called for Biden a few days after the November 3 election, Trump and his allies have mounted a string of dozens of legal challenges, almost all of which have been defeated, or rejected, or tossed out, including by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Electoral College this week confirmed the results, with Biden earning 306 Electoral College votes and Trump 232. That prompted many Republicans who had previously held back to finally say they consider Trump the president-elect. Feenstra, during Thursday's recording, said he's not ready to do that until Congress confirms the Electoral College results. Meantime, he is one of roughly two dozen congressional Republicans who signed a letter to Democratic U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asking her to investigate the election results. The great thing about our country is that we have this foundation of this electoral process, and we saw that play out this past Monday when the Electoral College cast their votes, and then we have the opportunity to do that on January 6th, and I look forward to that opportunity, Feenstra said. This is the first time ever in our country that we've had mail-in ballot predominantly, Feenstra added, so I think we all want to make sure to protect what we have, and there's still some litigation out there. For me, it's all about let's make sure that litigation is done and let's move forward. More than 100 million early ballots were cast nationwide in the 2020 elections. Of the roughly 60 lawsuits filed by the Trump campaign and its allies, only one has been successful, a minor ruling that did not significantly change any vote totals. The legal challenges have not been successful in proving any voter fraud occurred. Feenstra is headed to Congress after defeating nine-term incumbent U.S. Representative Steve King in the Republican primary in June. Feenstra then won a comfortable victory over Democrat J.D. Scholten in the general election in November. During Thursday's recording, Feenstra said he hopes future COVID-19 pandemic relief bills will include more assistance for small businesses and for businesses and workers in the food supply chain. He also expressed a desire to work on reining in federal government spending. When asked about sustaining the Social Security program long-term, Feenstra said one way to help is by having a balanced budget and reducing national debt. How you make sure that the system is sustainable is managing your debt and managing your budget. And right now, we have an out-of-control system, Feenstra said. So I'm sort of a fiscal hawk, simply saying you have to control your spending. If you control your spending, then you can start making sure that everything else is sustainable, like Social Security and Medicare. This episode of Iowa Press will air on Iowa PBS on Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at noon. It will also be available online at iowapbs.org. And now on the second page, we have the regular feature, Face of the Day, and that is of Mattie Misfelt, M-I-S-F-E-L-D-T, Mattie Misfelt. It says Mattie Misfelt loves her Longfellow family. Misfelt is a native of Clinton, and her family moved to Council Bluffs when she was a fourth grader. She was a student in the Lewis Central Community School District and graduated from high school in 2012. After graduating, Misfelt attended the University of Northern Iowa to study education. She said that growing up, she knew she wanted a career in helping people. She thought about getting into social work, but she really wanted to work in more of a classroom environment. I've always had a drive to help people who can't necessarily help themselves, she said. Education drew me in. I knew that I could touch lives in ways that I maybe couldn't if I was on a different route. She graduated from UNI in 2016 and came back to Council Bluffs to student teach at Longfellow Elementary School before taking a full-time position, and she's been teaching third graders there ever since. She said she couldn't imagine landing at a better school than Longfellow, noting excellent students and staff, and an environment that has helped her grow as well. I love this Longfellow family, she said. I've learned a lot during my time here about how to be a better teacher, be a better human. I think our staff is so strong, and it's demonstrated every day. Outside the classroom, Misfelt loves playing volleyball and being active. She has an almost one-year-old corgi puppy named George, who she said is always the most popular guy in the room. She can often be found taking him on runs and walks. She's looking forward to a little rest and relaxation during the district's winter break. The article is accompanied by the Mattie Misfelt, and the article is provided to us by Joe Shearer. There is no opinion page in today's edition, but there is included a part two of the insert, The Year in Review 2020. And I will read one of the articles reported by Tim Johnson. It's under the heading Community Stars of 2020. And the title, Teachers, School Staff Keep Things Going in Pandemic. Teachers, paraeducators, and other school staff members have worked hard and taken risks to keep instruction going during the COVID-19 pandemic. That puts them among our community stars for 2020. Everyone has made sacrifices and changes due to the virus, said Sherry Anderson, president of the Council Bluffs Education Association. During a prolonged school shutdown in the spring, teachers were out of their classrooms and tried to connect with their students via the internet with Zoom, Google Meet, and other software. But since last spring's online enrichment activities were not required, some students' faces rarely, if ever, appeared on their screens. Many teachers made signs or participated in teacher parades to show their students they cared about them. College View, Franklin, Lewis and Clark, Longfellow, Roosevelt, and Rue Elementary Schools all had parades or reverse parades when families drive by schools, as did Kreft Primary School, so teachers and students could connect with each other. Besides drive-by greetings, there were no goodbyes at the end of the spring term because schools never reopened. In August, teachers and students returned to school, but it was unlike anything they had ever experienced. Masks became standard apparel, and applying hand sanitizer became a regimen practiced several times a day. Everyone was expected to socially distance as best they could, and every day school staff members faced some risk of infection with the coronavirus. In some school systems, students attended in person full-time. Usually masks were expected, but social distancing was not always possible. In Council Bluffs Community School District, teachers faced a hybrid schedule, teaching half of their students in person each day and half via the internet, with the two groups attending in person on alternating days. While providing instruction to the pupils in their classrooms, they had to also find ways to reach to those connecting electronically from home. Many found themselves carrying a heavier workload and struggling with unfamiliar software to reach students at home. Some found it difficult to engage students attending virtually. Some found they had less time to spend with their families. All of it combined to create more stress for teachers and paraeducators. Teachers are perfectionists, Thomas Jefferson High School teacher Shannon Dunlap said during the Board of Education meeting. We want to give 100% in everything we do. We know the only way to help our students is to push on through. Yet somehow teachers have adapted, said Council Bluffs Superintendent Vicki Murillo. Throughout my career in education, there has never been a time like this that has prompted educators to be more creative and innovative, she said. Every single person in our organization has stepped up to the plate to make necessary changes for the well-being of our students. I'm extremely proud of our teaching staff, who are becoming more and more skilled at providing instruction and support to students in person and online. We are grateful for their resiliency and determination, and equally thankful for the parents who have partnered with us during this unprecedented time. On October 12, the school district allowed students to voluntarily return to attending in person every day. This caught some teachers off guard and made it more challenging to social distance in some classes. Some did not feel safe at school. Some hesitated to stay home when they were under the weather because they knew there was a shortage of substitutes and were afraid someone unaccustomed to working with students would be pulled in to cover for them. But after the Thanksgiving weekend, the district returned to the hybrid mode. I am glad we are in hybrid because this mode allows for social distancing much more than regular classes, Anderson said. The kids are wearing masks, washing hands, and staying 6 feet apart as much as possible, which hopefully will help slow the spread and prevent overwhelming our hospitals. Roosevelt Elementary School Principal Brett Abbott said teachers at his school have created a supportive environment for students who have also had to adjust to many changes. Our teachers have developed a sense of community in the classroom and school where students feel supported and know they have an adult they can trust, he said. It has been an exciting transition to observe our teachers be amazing problem solvers and just fix it when they had no prior experience or knowledge of how this might look or feel. Bottom line, our teachers are creative problem solvers who have accomplished so much over these last few months, and they continue to get better at it each and every day. The article is accompanied by a couple of color pictures. The first, teacher Amanda Fontaine left, gives first grader Mary Gray some hand sanitizer as she enters her classroom during the first day at Heartland Christian School on August 20. And a second picture shows a teacher seemingly offering an elbow bump to one of her students, who is a young girl wearing a colorful backpack, and she's accompanied by another classmate wearing a bright orange backpack. And the caption says, College View Elementary School third grader teacher Lisa Williams on the right gives one of her students an elbow bump outside the school following the final bell of the day on October 13th. And there is a third picture. It shows a teacher sitting at a chair, and she has, in the foreground, there is a laptop opened with the screen obviously showing some presentation. And the caption says, First grade teacher Amy Kuhn works with students in the classroom and online simultaneously at Roosevelt Elementary School on December 9th. Another article in the year in review section, 2020, Community Stars of 2020, local grocery retail store employees step up as the new essentials. This is reported by Courtney Brummer Clark. Of those who worked in grocery and some retail stores, if they didn't know how essential they were to a community's well-being, they do now. The COVID-19 pandemic gave many of us a newfound respect for those employees who kept groceries, prescriptions, and other necessary supplies stocked and available to the general public, all while putting themselves at risk during the largest healthcare crisis of this century. On March 26, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a proclamation that temporarily closed retail businesses across the state. The closures include bookstores, clothing and shoe stores, jewelry stores, luggage stores, cosmetic, beauty, and perfume stores, florists, and furniture and home furnishing stores. The order did not affect other retail establishments such as discount stores, grocery stores, or pharmacies that sell these goods in addition to other essential food, medical supplies, and household goods, the proclamation stated. This left department stores like Target and Walmart to remain open. Many grocery and other stores that carried essential supplies, such as Walmart and Target, announced special shopping hours that would be reserved for customers at higher risk for contracting the illness. For example, on March 19, Hy-Vee stores announced they would reserve 1 hour of shopping time each day for customers at higher risk for illness. Customers age 60 or older, expectant mothers, and anyone with an underlying health condition that makes them more vulnerable to illness were given a special shopping time. Grocery stores throughout the metro area began requiring employees to wear masks while on the job to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. In May, Hy-Vee announced that all store and distribution center employees throughout its 8-state region were required to wear masks and other facial coverings while at work in response to the evolving COVID-19 outbreak. Hy-Vee provided masks to all employees over the past several weeks. Wearing a mask or other facial covering inside Hy-Vee stores became mandatory for employees to help protect both employees and customers. The move was among many features Hy-Vee said at the time that it took to ensure the health and well-being of its employees and customers over the past several weeks. Other efforts included temporary plexiglass barriers installed at all checkout stands and pharmacy customer service and convenience store counters, social distancing indicators on the floor, wherever lines typically form in the store, one-way directional signage for all aisles, sanitation of all carts and check stand belts between each customer use, and special shopping times for those considered most at risk for illness. In addition, to show its gratitude to employees, Hy-Vee is providing frontline employee appreciation bonuses to all of its part-time and full-time store employees. The employees receive a 10% bonus on all their hours worked from March 16 to April 12, an additional 10% bonus on hours worked between April 13 through May 3rd. In Iowa and Nebraska, customers of Family Fare and Supermercado Nuestra Familia were asked to start wearing masks unless they are medically unable to, a spokeswoman said. Spartan Nash, parent company of the two grocery chains and fifth largest food distributor in the nation, announced that it is requiring all employees and customers to wear masks. An exception was made for those medically unable to do so, such as asthmatics. All Super Saver employees were required to wear masks as well, according to Marty Jarvis, director of marketing for Super Saver. Super Saver was also taking precautions like ensuring every store is sanitized and well-stocked, according to the store website at supersaver.com. Another service to help with precautions included ordering food through Instacart online so it can be left outside residents' homes, according to the website. We hope everyone stays safe and healthy, and we're happy to and proud to be part of a public service right now for our customers, Jarvis said. We're glad we can help. Aldi began requiring all store and warehouse employees to wear masks or face coverings starting on April 24, according to a press release from the grocery chain. This was asked of business partners that work or enter their facilities as well. The release said Aldi could provide a mask. However, employees are welcome to bring a face covering from home that meets CDC guidelines. Signage and floor decals were added to promote safe social distancing, the release said. Fairway has also added signage and floor markings to remind customers to social distance at check stands, meat counters, produce, and dairy sections. They are also providing employees with disposable masks, along with providing training on how to use a facial mask and clean a cloth mask. We strongly encourage customers to follow proper hygiene and mask usage as recommended by the CDC, and we appreciate their confidence while shopping, Fairway said Emily Toribio, Fairway Stores Incorporated Corporate Outreach and Communications Manager. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called on people to wear masks when they can't be certain of staying 6 feet from others, and especially has cited grocery stores as a place to wear masks. Grocery and retail locations found other ways to give back to the community. In November, Hy-Vee announced that it would hire for more than 1,000 jobs across the Council Bluffs Omaha metro area. The opportunity worked perfectly for Bluffs residents who are out of work or have had their hours cut back as a result of the ongoing COVID pandemic. In April and May, Fairway Stores donated $3,000 worth of gift cards to the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce. The donation was part of $200,000 a donation the grocery chain made to the Iowa Chamber of Commerce executives. The donation was broken down into $50 gift cards and distributed to help small local businesses and their employees. Amid the changes in their work days, including how and when they worked, some local grocery and retail employees, the previously unknown essentials, found ways to keep things light for their fellow staff members and the public as well. After the COVID-19 pandemic affected the store's operating hours, causing it to close earlier than normal, Council Bluffs Walmart store associates Abby Anderson and Jana Hightower Ostik decided to make those store closing announcements a little more fun. Taking to Facebook, the duo, who work at the North 16th Street Walmart location in Council Bluffs, have come up with creative and musical announcements and shared them with the public. Bluffs Walmart store associates Abby Anderson and Jana Hightower Ostik decided to make those store closing announcements a little more fun. The videos feature parodies of songs like Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice and the theme song from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. To check out the hilarious hijink, check out their Facebook group called Closing Announcements and Other Equally Wonderful Stuff. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil, on this Friday, December 18th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Philip Leroy Henke died on December 12th. Funeral services Saturday, 10 a.m. at the Maher Funeral Home. Visitation starting 1 hour prior to the service, 9 a.m. Interment, Memorial Park Cemetery. As mentioned, the Maher Funeral Home is handling arrangements for the family of Philip Leroy Henke. Yvonne Stucker, 86, of Council Bluffs, died in her sleep December 14 at Bethany Lutheran Home. The funeral service will be held Saturday, December 19th at 10 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Funeral Home in Council Bluffs. A visitation with family will be held at 9 a.m. No luncheon will be served because of COVID-19, and those present for the service are asked to observe the protocols required. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Children's Square. The Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home is handling arrangements for Yvonne Stucker. We have Leroy V. Dolan, age 72, of Minden, Iowa, died December 15 as a result of injuries he sustained in an accident on November 16th. Open viewing and visitation will be held 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Saturday, December 19. There will be a private family graveside service. The family will direct memorials for Leroy V. Dolan, whose arrangements are being handled by the Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home and Cremation Service. And finally, David Seelstad, 61, of Council Bluffs, died unexpectedly on December 15th. Funeral service, open viewing and visitation will be held 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Friday, December 18th. Family will be present from 5 to 7 p.m. The funeral service will be held 10 a.m. at McPherson Avenue Church of Christ on Saturday, December 19. Interment is in the Garner Township Cemetery. Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home and Cremation Service is handling arrangements for the family of David Seelstad. Now we turn to the sports page for a couple of prep stories. Lewis Central grapplers split with Kemper Catholic Atlantic CAM. Reported by Justin Heinen, the Titans hosted a triangular on their home mats where they battled two Hawkeye 10 foes as they topped Kemper Catholic but then fell to Atlantic CAM. The Titans started their night with a duel against Hawkeye 10 foe Kemper. Sam Barrientos at 285 and Ava McNeil at 106 got the Titans off to a strong start as they accounted for two of the duel's 9 pins, 7 of which were done within the first period. Titans coach August Manns was very pleased with the focus of his wrestlers came out with as they defeated the Knights 59-24 to win their first duel of the night. They came out aggressive, Mann said. One of the things we talked about this week was coming out aggressive and making each match a physical match. That mindset really paid off in the first duel. The Titans had a little break before they took on Atlantic CAM for their next duel. This time the script flipped, as it was the Trojans who set an early tempo. At first, the teams traded off wins. However, the Trojans were winning by pins, while the Titans won by decisions, which led to LC's defeat, 54-17. Coach Tim Duff does a great job over there in Atlantic, Mann said. It really shows as they were stingy about giving up back points or any type of points. We had to battle it out to get some decisions, and we just weren't as stingy as they. The Titans will be back on the mats this weekend, though, against some stellar Class 3A competition. We expect to see Bettendorf and Southeast Polk there, Mann said. We'll be playing some good competition there, and we're excited to see where we stand. Lewis Central will head to Southeast Polk this Saturday at 10 a.m. Then the article gives the rundown of each of the individual matches, as we have Atlantic CAM 54, Kemper 22, Lewis Central 59, Kemper 24. We have then for the final Atlantic CAM 54 and Lewis Central 17. The article is accompanied by a picture of a couple of wrestlers in action, and the caption says, Braylon Cameron left, won both of his matches in Thursday night's triangular. Here, he eventually pins Kemper's Mason Rohe. And our second story is in college volleyball. Former LC Titan Rachel Cushing named GPAC Libero of the Year. This is reported by Derek Horan. Former Lewis Central multi-sport standout Rachel Cushing has continued to shine at the next level for College of St. Mary in Omaha. After a stellar true freshman campaign this past season, Cushing was named to the 2020 Great Plains Athletic Conference Volleyball First Team and was named the GPAC Libero of the Year. In her first season with the Flames, Cushing led not only the GPAC but the entire country in digs with 440. Jamestown won the regular season championship for 2020 with a 15-1 record, while College of St. Mary has an overall record of 11-10 with a 6-10 conference mark. The GPAC volleyball tournament will be played in the spring, April 3, 7, and 10. The NAIA tournament opening round is scheduled for April 17 and will be played at host campus sites. The rest of the tourney is slated for April 27 to May 1st at the Tyson Event Center in Sioux City. The GPAC all-conference teams were selected by the league coaches. And then the article concludes with a listing of the first team and second teams, as mentioned. Now we go back to a regional news story. The federal government ordered to pay landowners on Lower Mississippi River. This is from Omaha, and it's an Associated Press story. The federal government must pay some landowners along the Lower Missouri River for flooding damage caused by changes the Army Corps of Engineers made to the river to protect endangered species, a judge has ruled. The ruling last week by Senior Judge Nancy Firestone with the U.S. Court of Federal Claims could cost the government millions of dollars and increase the cost of protecting endangered species, the Omaha World Herald reported. This is a big deal, said Anthony Schultz, an associate law professor at the University of Nebraska. The potential liability could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, depending upon how many people are included. The ruling affects land along the river from Sioux City, Iowa to St. Louis, although not all landowners will qualify for compensation and not all flood-related damages will be covered. Firestone ruled that the Corps caused increased flooding by changing the river's flow to improve habitat for some species to comply with the Endangered Species Act. The agency violated constitutional protections against taking property without compensation because it did not pay landowners for the damage, she said. Attorney Dan Boulware, who represented more than 400 plaintiffs in the lawsuit, said his firm has tried unsuccessfully to negotiate a settlement with the government. He expects the government to appeal. The government needs to step up and do what's right, he said. Neither the Corps nor the U.S. Justice Department would comment on the ruling, the World Herald reported. U.S. senators from Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas wrote a letter to the Secretary of the Army last month urging the agency to settle the case. The Corps continues to ignore clear liability for its actions and instead expresses its intent to exhaust all appeals for years to come, the senators wrote. We once again strongly urge that the Corps cease further delay and make our constituents whole. It is not a class action lawsuit, so each individual plaintiff's case is judged separately to determine if damages are warranted. Firestone said a test sample showed 16 of 44 property owners didn't qualify for damages. The lawsuit involves flooding from 2007 to 2015, except for damages from historic flooding in 2011. It also does not include flooding last year, which occurred after the case was brought. The judge ruled that the Corps caused an average reduction in land values of about 25% along the river. A specific dollar amount for the losses has not been determined. The Corps does not have to pay for crop damage or damage to farm equipment and buildings, Firestone said. Boldwater said the plaintiffs are considering whether to appeal that part of the ruling. Instead, the Corps must pay for a flowage easement, a term for privately owned land on which the Corps has some perpetual rights. The terms for the Corps' use of land involved in this case must still be determined. The article is accompanied by a colored picture of a all-too-familiar sight. The caption says, a home is surrounded by Missouri River floodwaters October 22, 2019, in Bartlett. A judge ruled, as the article said, that the federal government must pay landowners on the lower Missouri River for flooding damage caused by the Corps of Engineers' efforts to protect endangered species. And we return to the year-in-review section for an article, Community Stars of 2020. This one, First Responders Deal with the Pandemic on the Front Lines, and it's reported by Mike Brownlee. Since COVID-19 made its way to Pottawatomie County, first responders have adjusted while doing their work in the area. The impact includes changes to the way fire and emergency medical service first responders approach calls, while coronavirus infections coupled with retirements has left the department short-staffed. It's been a very challenging year for us, not unlike it is for hospital workers and law enforcement, school teachers, and everyone else, EMS Division Chief Rick Benson said. Fire Chief Justin James said, the pandemic has changed EMS responses probably forever. Benson said COVID-19 has changed how paramedics and firefighters do their job. The department has instituted protocols to protect both firefighters and medics and the public from COVID-19 while working with healthcare providers to make sure it gets patients to their right facility, the right level of care, by the right mode of transportation. He said department staff wears personal protective equipment on all calls, while 9/11 screening questions have been adjusting to gauge for potential exposures, and contamination protocols are followed after calls. In October, Benson said the department averages about 23 calls per day, and among those, 4 to 5 are calls to take COVID-19 patients to the hospital. Hospitalizations locally have increased dramatically in the last month. On calls, when possible, the department now asks those affected to come outside instead of waiting for EMS and firefighters to come inside at residences, health clinics, and long-term care facilities. With EMS, it's stressful. Before COVID, it was stressful. You add the unknown of COVID, Benson said. The extra work of masks and gowns, eye protection, PPE, and then decontamination and isolation, it just adds up. A lot of workload, a lot of stress to the firefighters. Both Benson and James praised the men and women of the fire department for rising to the occasion during the pandemic, despite the myriad obstacles before them. They're doing a great job, James said, adding that something that has helped is the fire and police in this community have great support from the public. Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office Deputy Richard Hyatt discussed the impact on law enforcement. Hyatt contracted COVID-19 in September and recovered after experiencing mild symptoms. He isn't sure how he caught it, but said he was lucky it wasn't worse. It's hurt a lot of people, said Hyatt, who's been in the office almost 7 years and been in law enforcement for 17 years. When he's on calls, people are cautious, he said. Law enforcement agencies across the area have made sure officers have the pandemic tools of the trade, masks and the like, to keep them safe while in the field. Hyatt noted an effect of the pandemic has been the communication difficulties presented with wearing a mask. Whether talking to a victim or a suspect, the deputies worked to make sure he speaks clearly and slowly with his mask on to make sure they know what's going on. though sometimes masks make it difficult to understand what people are saying. You have to talk a little bit louder and a little bit slower, and they do as well. I hate to have someone have to repeat themselves, Hyatt said, especially when gathering information from a victim. The more they repeat it, the more worked up they get about what happened. I try to listen a little more carefully. Muffled voices, among the many challenges the pandemic has wrought. 2020 has been a different ball game, that's for sure, Hyatt said. The article is accompanied by a picture of, well, a couple of pictures. One of a team of first responders, firefighters, and the caption says, from left, Council Bluffs Fire Department Captain Curtis McKeon, firefighter Brandon Ariza, and engineer Dan Morse, inside the department headquarters on November 2020. They're standing behind one of those rolling emergency gurneys. And we have a second picture of a Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office Deputy Richard Hyas, helping parents of Trainer High School students unload a truck full of wares from a prom committee fruit sale at the town's volunteer fire department headquarters on December 8th. And the subject in the picture is carrying what looks like a stack of three boxes from an unloaded delivery truck. From the back are also students also receiving and carrying boxes to the school. We have a couple of pictures presented by staff photographer Joe Shearer, big title, Oh Deer, and it's pictures of deer, one of them standing sideways to the camera and looking sideways, as I would say, to the camera, and they're both pictures of deer in a snow-covered field, and the site is the south side of Lake Manawa State Park, and these were taken on Wednesday. They're white-tailed deer, and there's a second picture. Both of them, of the larger deer, have horns, and there's a picture of a smaller deer accompanied by the deer, as the deer seems to be walking slowly to the left of the picture. And finally, just a glance at the weather section. Emily Scheib reports sunny skies continue well into next week for the Council Bluffs Omaha area. Today, we will have highs in the upper 30s, mostly sunny skies in the afternoon, according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. South wind could gust as high as 20 miles per hour through the day, and tonight temps could drop down into the teens, with a north wind gusting as high as 16 miles per hour at times. It says for tomorrow, we can expect a sunny day with a high near 31, north-northwest wind around 6 p.m., becoming southwest in the afternoon, and Saturday night partly cloudy, a low around 21. Sunday looks like a high near 41. Sunday night partly cloudy with a low around 32. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil, on this Friday, December 18th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.